Hello, welcome to the podcast Sport and Life. I hope you're well. Teddy Draper here, sports broadcaster in the UK. Stay tuned momentarily for a conversation with Aaron Radin, the CEO of the British Basketball League, the BBL in the UK. Fine American gentleman and good to riff on the organisation, but also the sport of basketball as a global entity. And why maybe it's not as popular as it could be here in the UK. We'll talk about that momentarily. First of all, want to give some messages to the sponsors. I want to tell you actually about a project that my wife and I have been working on since lockdown. Very rewarding project, speaking to members of the public about their life stories. I sit down with them for a good sort of 90 minutes, 2 hour chat from childhood all the way up to present day. Great for getting grandmum's life story, granddad's, or even mum, dad, even your own if you'd like to. And it's just good for loved ones, I believe, to get those personal anecdotes, those details of a story before it's too late in all real terms, something that we've done with all our family members now. And I found it completely rewarding, but just members of the public I enjoy speaking to as well, particularly from different eras who grew up in the 1940s, 50s, very illuminating and relevant also to some of the things that potentially we're going through now. So I find it very fascinating. If you want to find out more about it, go to atticboxaudio.co.uk or drapermedia.co.uk. Big thank you to the chief sponsor of the podcast, Bang & Olufsen of Cheltenham, and Serene AV, Jason Briggs and his team, specialists in some of the finest home entertainment brands, providing solutions based around high quality customer service and installation. It's got a beautiful store in the courtyard in Montpellier here in Cheltenham, or you can look them up online through Serene AV. Remember the association that Sports and Life has now have or has partnered with Herring Shoes, English family shoemaking business, which Richard Herring started in 1966. Handmade classic shoes. Head to herringshoes.co.uk for more and a checkout with the podcast discount code of TED10, T-E-D, all capital letters, then the numerals 10, and that applies to all full price shoes over £20. So remember the association as well. If you're looking to optimize your immunity, the podcast has with Cytoplan. If you head to cytoplan.co.uk, C-Y-T-O-P-L-A-N.co.uk, you can get 30% off your first purchase of any of their food-based supplements, digested as close to food would be, and 10% ongoing with the code DRAPER10R. My last name, D-R-A-P-E-R, all capital letters, numerals 10, and the capital letter R. Remember, my father's been a steward of us taking Cytoplan supplements for 2 decades and do believe in them in terms of maintaining that health month to month, day to day. Well, thank you for listening to this introduction. Remember, if you want a mentoring session with Anthony Asprey, the Holman Academy, there's a notes in the show notes, a link to that. But right now, let's get on to the CEO of the BBL, Aaron Radin. Aaron Radin, welcome to the podcast. Great to meet you virtually. How are you?
Nice to meet you too. Thanks for making time. I appreciate you having me on.
Brilliant. Well, it's good to have you here. It must be a busy time as well. You're CEO of British Basketball League, BBL, a few months into the job. How's that all going?
Oh, it's been a blast. It's fun. It's hard. there are innumerable things that we need to work on. And so, you know, I think, look, a big part of the role so far has really been prioritization. It's like there's so many things that we can do. There's so many opinions of things that can be improved, of how to grow the sport, of how to grow this league within the sport. And you know, most of what I spent my initial months doing is really focusing on the future, like what is next year and beyond looking like, and how do we position ourselves to be prepared for that? And you know, of that very long list that we put together, and it's, you know, not done yet, what are the things, given, you know, today the limited resources that we're working with, that we need to focus on in order to make those improvements?
Yeah, it's interesting the way the UK sits in the sport of basketball, because I had the good fortune of doing a master's in journalism in the States, and I was reporting on high school basketball. It was absolutely huge, which was, I guess, some real highs and some real lows. If you wrote anything contentious, the local parents and coaches would come after you. Or it was the passion for the sport was huge. And then when I came back to the UK, I used that to do some commentary for the world feed of the Asian Games in 2006 in Doha. And it was again an eye-opening experience, because you realize how
international basketball is, you know, behind football, soccer as probably one of the world's sports. But the UK is quite unique in that sense. I suppose it's been like trying to bring football or soccer to America 50 years ago. How do you see where basketball sits in the UK in the cultural kind of mindset?
Well, I appreciate that you use the word cultural at the end because I think that's a really big part of it, and it's a really big part of sort of what I'm learning about sport here in particular. So if you take football, for example, my sense is that fandom is almost like being born into a religion here. Like you're born a Catholic, a Protestant, a Jew, a Muslim. You know, here you're born Man U, you're born Liverpool, you're born Everton, and you know, unless something crazy happens, you don't leave, you know, what you've been born into, and you know, you're almost like a black sheep if you leave, and your family's like, wait a second, you're not, you know, you're, God forbid, you're a Liverpool fan and you
It's a
became a Man
tribe.
U fan, right? Exactly. So even, and I think that actually permeates almost the fan experience when you go to a match and you sort of see, you know, everybody's there, and I sort of look around and like most people are watching, but a lot of it has to do with just the being there, the communal experience, the singing the songs, the wearing your colors, representing who you are from the tribe. Basketball, of course, doesn't have that lineage here,
No.
nor does it have the association with those clubs, and you know, that's sort of a separate conversation as to whether that would make sense or not.
Oh yeah, because Spain does have, doesn't it? Spain has very
Spain
powerful.
does exactly. So, you know, basketball is, you know, unlike sort of being born into, it's much more about self-identification, I suppose. And, you know, I think self-identification is something that more closely relates to youth. You know, I think it's, you know, anyone who's getting older, like I am,
Me too.
the older you get, you know, the more perhaps resistant to change you might become. And so, you know, if you sort of step back and sort of think about all of those things, it's like, okay, how do we begin to market to those audiences that are open to self-identification, perhaps even biased towards? There already is a really high level of participation in the sport. Of course, not all of that is related to the activities of or has been related to the activities of the British Basketball League. And so, you know, how can we sort of pull a thread from the league to that level of participation, activity, interest, and draw them, you know, through, you know, self-identification to sort of like, now I'm a Bristol Flyers fan, I'm a Sheffield Sharks fan, I'm a London Lions fan, and engagement with the league. And that's really almost like, you know, I talk about the thread, like threading the needle of how do we make those connections. And, you know, there's sort of the traditional, if you will, tools to do it. Put a game on a broadcast, we're on Sky. You know, is that, it's interesting because there's sort of, I wouldn't call it conflict, but challenge, I suppose, for the broadcasters. As you know, you're on Sky, like the audience is principally an older audience. Young people aren't watching television as much. We have a young audience for our sport. Would we be able to draw them to it through a traditional sort of linear presentation? Perhaps. Perhaps if it's formatted differently, like there's different things that we can do to make that more attractive. Could we attract them through other media means? Perhaps. Like I think, you know, we need to be prepared to sort of explore and optimize our content for each of those formats to make those connections that I'm describing. So, you know, any and all of that is sort of an enormous challenge. And I suppose it's a unique challenge in this market in particular because of sort of the more traditional sports, if you will, football, rugby, cricket, you know, things that sort of have history and custom to them, I suppose, in terms of the way that they've been presented. Of course, cricket is attempting to do many different sort of, in some ways, radically different things in order to present the sport, in many ways, to resonate with a lot of the things that I'm describing.
How does the relationship with the NBA works? I know you've worked for the NBA.
I have.
Global brand. And I know that for a lot of people, they'll still think basketball. They'll think LeBron James. You talk about the individualization of it. I think that what basketball is great historically is that people identify with individuals almost more than the teams. And you probably say that might be different, but I know in the States, teams have even moved around franchises and things like that sometimes. And actually people follow the big names, the big faces. You know, when I was growing up, it was Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and people like that who were actually household names in the UK at the time, which was amazing because it was on Channel 4, which was we had five regular channels at the time in the 90s. So that was a big exposure. But I just wonder is it complementary to the BBL's ambitions or is it competitive to drawing away attention?
It might be a little bit of both. I mean, we're not competing from a time slot standpoint. I mean, everything's about competing for attention and it's not just, you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's set that aside. I think it's complementary in the sense of like the more interest that there is in basketball, the better the opportunity, I suppose, it creates for us. And, you know, again, I sort of go back to what I was saying before. Then we've got to figure out how to capitalize on that opportunity that's created as a function of the strong level of interest in the sport. So in that sense, it's absolutely beneficial for us. I think that I don't know how to call it competitive. Like you made this note about the player identification.
Mm.
So it's interesting. I think, you know, one of the great opportunities for us in the British Basketball League is the storytelling. There are really some compelling, loads of compelling stories about the athletes, about the clubs, about the history. And like any sport, it's how you connect with the individuals that really gives that emotive connection. You know, again, that's why football is somewhat different because it's sort of born in you're born into the connection and then you know, it either gets enhanced or, you know, because you start to root for the individual players on the club.
Mm.
I think in the NBA's case, you know, you sort of reference this sort of like it's a players league and people follow players and like I root for LeBron James, whether he's on the Cavs, the Lakers, the Heat, wherever.
Yeah.
Or Kevin Durant or, you know. And I wonder, I think that's been enormously beneficial for the sport and actually sport in general, athletes. And I wonder if as much of the storytelling could have been about the clubs as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And creating the association and the fandom that comes with rooting for the outcome of that club's performance. And whether if it's skewed too far or not, I couldn't, you know, I'm not going to judge one way or another because I think it has been beneficial. But it is interesting, you know, just from a sport presentation, I think, you know, there's both that and then there's sort of format. Are you presenting sort of longer form storytelling? Are you presenting sort of like bite size updates? You know, I was just reading the other day a column, just an opinion column about some of the challenges that the NBA is having, particularly in the US in terms of viewership, because a lot of the broadcast is focused on, sort of called it like the, you know, Twitter on TV. Because it's about like the latest updates, making sure you break the latest piece of news versus the more in-depth sort of storytelling that can happen during a game, for example.
So people not wanting to watch a whole game, is that part of it? We've heard that maybe.
It is a challenge these days. And so, you know, again, you want to, how you design, market, present your product, something we're certainly spending an inordinate amount of time, extraordinary amount of time thinking about and planning for going forward. To try and create the most compelling broadcast product for sure, but you know, then how does, you know, the broadcast serve as sort of the top of the pyramid, if you will, and then, you know, all the different content pieces that flow from it, from a game.
It's interesting. You mentioned the attention economy, and I know you worked for Meta before, I believe, which people may know as Facebook more commonly. How do you see that, the challenge in the modern times? Because is it harder now than it was 20 years ago to reach people in a sense, even though there's more platforms and more it's easier to publish content, but actually to captivate people is more difficult.
Right. Well, you made the point before, there used to be 5 networks.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I grew up, it was 3 networks in the US. So like, you know, when I got home from school, when I was a kid, I turned on the TV and I got reruns of I Love Lucy and Gilligan's Island. You know, that was it. That was the only choice I had if I wanted to be entertained with video. Now you have limitless choice, right? And so I think that introduces opportunities and challenges. The opportunity is that the marginal cost of distribution is zero. If I want to produce a show and stick it on YouTube, it costs me nothing to do that. Historically, if you wanted to produce a show and have it distributed, it was an enormous cost of entry. I mean, one, you had to have the relationships. Two, you had to have the production budgets and a certain level of standard. Three, you had enormous competition to get into those time slots. Like, you know, probably a lot of this will sound like, what the heck are these guys talking about? I don't understand. Like, I can get anything anywhere these days, you know, particularly for younger people in the audience. Today, your marginal cost of distribution is zero. I can produce a show. In fact, if we were videoing this show, we could put it on YouTube and it would cost us nothing.
Sure.
And we might get an audience because they found our content compelling. And, you know, they might choose to watch us versus watching the BBC NewsHour or, you know, any other zillions of things that they could be spending their time on. So that is, you know, a principal challenge. I think it's, you know, even I didn't intend to, but I'll come back to the football point. Football is one of the things in this country where like you have just mass audience against and shared experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go back to sort of like the days of traditional television, if you will. And it used to be, you know, what's the water cooler moment? And the water cooler being you showed up at work the next day. And what are you guys talking about? What happened on XYZ show last night?
Yeah, it's hard now, isn't it? Everyone's watching different shows. So actually those conversations.
Everyone's watching different shows in different times. Like, you know, it's not like most shows are not done in a serialized way. They push the whole show out, for example. Mm. Some still are, but less. And so live sports is still one of those things.
But what about basketball? What captivates you about the sport? Were you a basketball player growing up, a fan of a team in particular? What do you think is its USP? Because it's incredibly athletic and dynamic, isn't it? I think is something that springs to mind for me.
It is. Yes, I played. Not well enough to play at a high level. I coached for a long time.
Oh, great.
In Brooklyn, I was involved in a grassroots program for about 20 years. Had multiple kids who ended up playing in the NBA, dozens of professional players.
Wow.
Nothing gave me a bigger rush, like of the sort of both the game experience itself, but also seeing people develop through it. Yeah. And that basketball really, you know, had the ability to change people's lives. Particularly, you know, I was mostly working with kids underprivileged inner city. Like this was a ticket out, or a ticket to a better life, and it worked in a lot of cases. So it just always had a very strong resonance for me. I loved it as an entertainment product. You know, I was a Boston Celtics fan from very early on. I was a huge Larry Bird fan, and just it stuck with me. I find the game enjoyable. It's fast. It's not like not a lot of dead time. You know, I was a baseball fan growing up as well. Baseball's a much slower, very stats oriented sport.
Red Sox fan as well. Were you a Red Sox?
I was a Red Sox fan, but you know, I think it sort of gets to some of the things that I'm going to try and draw a connection here, because, you know, and I've spoken about this before, and I'm borrowing this, it's not my line, you know, sports being principally a, you know, from a production standpoint about hope and memory. The hope is about building up the anticipation. It could be a debate over, should we play this player versus that one? Should we sign this player versus that one? And it all culminates in the actual game itself. Like, what is the outcome? The memory is about nostalgia. It's about when your team won or lost some really important match or game. You know, and so being a Red Sox fan, it was about misery for years and years.
Curse of the Bambino, was it? Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Always losing to the Yankees, like, and the feeling in the pit of your stomach. And then finally getting over the hump and finally winning and just like.
Yeah, what year was that? 2004, was it? 2004
was the, finally beat the Yankees. So, you know, I think, and that's one of the challenges that that we have in front of us with the British Basketball League is that there are many years of history. They're not widely known. Are we able to tell those stories and sort of almost retroactively create those memories? And if not, or even in addition to, we certainly want to focus on creating them going forward.
Yeah. And the actual, the way that the weather is in Britain and stuff like that lends itself to winters playing basketball, doesn't it? Indoors. And it always seems to me that it'd be a good fit for the country, really, I think.
Let's hope so. You know, I think it's also a sport that, you know, is important to play outside as well. So I'm certainly looking forward to the summers and, you know, sun going down very late so kids can be playing in the park until late. It's interesting. I had learned there's a park here in Clapham Common that Foot Locker helped build, I think, 3 courts, and I had heard about it and seen some clips of it, and they did a nice, you know, nice design of the park. And I was over there one night. It was like probably 8-10 degrees out.
Yeah.
You know, like most days here, not pouring, but sort of like a mist falling
drizzle.
And I was over there at night, and I just have, you know, I was like, oh, I'm here. Let me go take a look at this park. The park was full of kids playing in the rain and the dark.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
It was like, it was great. And it just shows, you know, the level of appetite that there is.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful that we can create more opportunities like that for kids to get involved. And again, as I said at the beginning, how do you connect them to the British Basketball League as well?
And it's interesting. Yeah, you referenced before that the football sort of tribalism we have and the proximity. And I suppose you coming from the northeast of the States is probably the only area you have that in the States, because everything's packed up in there, New York and Boston, whereas the rest of the country, you don't always get traveling fans going to away games, do you? Do you think some of the football culture could get into the BBL? Is that creating rivalries between cities because people can travel to games? It's a small country here.
I do think so. I do. And people travel in the US. They don't travel and have to separate them in their own cordoned off section.
No.
Because they're going to throw stuff at each other. Not that if you go to Yankee Stadium, people aren't throwing stuff at you if you're a Red Sox fan. But like, you know, you don't have it your own section, for example, at the stadium. But yes, I would love for that to become part of the culture. It's already starting to, and I see the sprouts of it in various markets. I think, you know, we have the cup final coming up this weekend in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Caledonia has made the cup final. So they're actually ending up the home team, and they're of course going to bring have a big contingent showing up, but Cheshire, which is the team now trying to defend their title, looks to be bringing a big group as well. So that'll be great. It'll be great to sort of have that. Like, you know, that's a final. You know, can that be in every game occurrence? Prospectively, you know, I think we'd like to get it to that point for sure. And we'd like to create the opportunity for it to happen.
Yeah, and I suppose international club competitions are always exciting for people, isn't it? How do you see the BBL obviously can qualify for Europe, but as the standard rises, I suppose the idea is you're then competitive and trying to win European titles.
For sure. I mean, London is playing in the Euro Cup tournament now. I would expect we'll have at least two clubs competing in Europe next year, potentially more. And we have multiple clubs that have the goal of playing international competition as well. I think it introduces opportunities and challenges to do that. Again, like creating the familiarization of a rivalry between Manchester and Newcastle, for example, versus Patras from Greece is going to show up on a random Wednesday. Like, what does the audience know about them versus, I'm competing in a European competition, and so I'm going to get excited because my club is playing at a different level. I think those are marketing challenges or sort of like content challenges. But I also think they're great opportunities for us to really create a deeper connection for the fans to lean in, particularly for the club, you know, from a storytelling standpoint. The players is sort of a different storytelling tactic, as you referenced before, particularly with the NBA. I think one of our challenges with respect to the player storytelling is, and you know, we've had this discussion with the clubs, is historically in Europe, players move around a lot.
Yeah.
And can we get them to stay on longer term deals?
Yeah.
Because it creates a longer story arc for us to tell their stories. The other thing that we haven't touched on, which is, you know, I think in sport here is that your success can be supercharged if the national team has any level of performance that augments what's going on in your domestic league.
Yes.
The current national team. Right. So the current national teams here, I suppose, would probably both admit they're not performing to the standard that they would want to. That being said, and, you know, I've been spending time with Chris Grant, who's the new chair of the British Basketball Federation. You know, it is important for us going forward to highlight the Team GB players in all of our media to make sure that we are telling the story, not only their stories, but the stories of their participation in the arc of the national team. Because going back to the point I made before, sports being about hope and memory, like hope is a huge portion of the journey.
Yeah.
Right.
Transfers in our football is the big thing, particularly at Sky Sports News. You have that window in August where that is essentially about hope. Fans are like, can we sign this player?
Fabrizio Romano has made an entire cottage industry of it.
He has, yeah.
It's all he does. There's not a depth to the story, and I'm not being critical. Mm. I think he would say the same thing. There's not a depth to the story. No. It's about breaking the story.
Mm.
And so that is a whole cottage industry. It is, and it is one of hope. I'm just, you know, the angle, if you will, that I'm sort of telling about it here is that, you know, the hope is about creating a level of hope, anticipation, excitement for what's the next step that Team GB is going to take on their journey, and that we can play a role in helping to tell that story. It may, ideally, it ends in a victory at the end, you know, going back to sort of my Red Sox drama, or trauma, really, is more like it. Mm. But even if it doesn't, you know, the journey is the important part. Like the England national men's team hasn't won, you know, and there's certainly a following. There's a anticipation level. It seems to always end in heartbreak and penalties. I think, you know, the good news is, like, you can't lose a basketball game in penalties.
No. The difficult thing with basketball, though, is you can't really park the bus, as they say, and block out the other team as easily, can you? Is there room for those sort of, I guess in America you call them Cinderella stories, where the underdog can triumph, or is it more predictable, do you feel?
Yes.
You can kind of tell.
I would separate the NBA from the rest of the world. The best players end up winning in the NBA. Like, unless you have a top five player in the world, it is very, very, very rare that you end up winning the title. The other thing is you're playing best out of seven series. So, like, over time, the better team is likely to prevail. In things where you have one game playoffs, like, anything can happen in one game. You might have an injury on the other team, like somebody might get hot. It's, you know, there's the, it's sort of small sample size, and you do have those opportunities where a team can come out of nowhere and potentially end up being, you know, winning the whole thing.
And with participation, it's really good that you said that it's a high participation level in the UK. Do you feel that people shouldn't be put off by having to be tall to play basketball? Is that something that people sometimes get concerned about? I don't know.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, in terms of the height of professional basketball players.
Oh, to be tall.
It's only for really tall.
No, people. Not at all. There was a game the other night where, like, the star player of the game was probably, couldn't have been more than 5'9", 5'10". No, speed, quickness. Actually, particularly at levels that aren't the highest levels of the sport, guards usually dominate.
Yeah.
It's when you get into higher level and a higher level of coaching where you have the structure to actually be able to take advantage of size.
Sure.
Now we're sort of getting into the weeds of, like,
no, it's interesting.
But, you know, even coaching, you know, coaching many, many years with kids from, like, 8 to 18 years old and playing tournaments all over the United States. And you would play against guys, you know, played against Kevin Garnett and Baron Davis and loads of, like, you know, great players. It was the guards who ended up dominating those tournaments.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like Muggsy Bogues, famously, wasn't he? He was a point guard.
Yes.
5'3", was he, something like that, I think?
He was 5'3", exactly. Yeah, as you get into more sort of, you know, structure, and you can, particularly, you know, if you have time to prepare, you can figure out how to exploit size.
I love it, and I love the participation thing. I just wondered, after being out in the States, I'd coached soccer on some summers over there in camps, and whether there was a comparison with Major League Soccer for the BBL, because clearly the participation was there for soccer in the US, but people weren't necessarily captivated by the domestic league. If they were football, soccer fans, they were looking at England or Spain or Italy for their entertainment.
And that's only really recent. Those games have been broadcast on air.
Yeah.
I mean, Premier League in the US is probably 7-8 years in, like, to being broadcast on NBC. And it would be hard to find those other matches. So are there analogies? Yes. I think the analogies, there's the obvious analogies, which is, you know, high participation sport, low commercial penetration.
Yeah. Like,
there's a gap, you know, here's the participation. There's, you know, in our case, my arm's not long enough yet. And I would say almost the same thing in the US.
It's turning players into fans, is it? Is that the key that you're trying to do?
It's that is a very interesting and apt analogy, which is MLS focused on very heavily on the fan experience, the in-game fan experience, creating a culture at these matches that was unique, certainly to US sports viewing.
Yeah.
I think we have that opportunity in part because we're sort of going through this transformation now where, you know, by the end of next year, half of our clubs will play in their own owned and operated facilities, which, you know, helps to enable you to create that culture. That's sort of one. Two is we're spending a lot of time now sort of planning what is an optimal run of show look like. And run of show is everything from what happens on the court to what happens in the stands to the combination of the two, the fan engagement. And I think where you're going, and sort of certainly what we're thinking, is through that fan experience, how do you enable your fans to become your best ambassadors for the sport?
Yeah, absolutely.
To do your marketing on your behalf to a large degree. And in that respect, it took many years in the MLS, I'm hope, more than hope, necessity that we can go faster here, and I think we can, is to enable that experience and start to generate that level of enthusiasm. And that can translate either into A, wow, that looks like a really fun experience, I want to be there in person. Nothing replaces the being there in person. To, if I can't be there, I want to experience it by watching watching the games and using the telecast to highlight that fan experience, but also enabling different tools or capabilities that allow the fans to tell their own stories. Social media, of course, is a great way to do that. But it's more than just, hey, I was at the game, I shot this highlight. What was my experience of being at the game? My experience of participating, you know, in the chant or whatever, or getting a chance to meet a player after the game and like stand next to a 7-footer or any and all of those things.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting that whole topic, and we won't spend too much more of your time because I know you're very busy gentlemen. But the US culture was that the Latino market for soccer was obviously big, and the fact that those people had maybe try and convert the rest of Americans into a love of the game and trying to captivate them, people from Mexico or different parts of the world who already knew about football and soccer. And I think maybe in the UK, as we've discussed it, basketball is a world sport, and actually any American expats over here, or Europeans, in fact, would probably help publicize it and promote the game, I'd imagine.
For sure. Although, yes, and, you know, I'd go back to the youth point. You know this, you're in the media business. You know, the most important audience are like adults 18 to 49. After the age of 49, you don't really matter anymore, except the pharmaceutical companies.
They still pay a lot of the bills, don't they?
But it's just a different type of marketing. And you know, part of the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, culture comes out of youth, or youth drives culture. And brands do everything they possibly can to attach themselves to cultural trends.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you have a captive audience like that, or you have, you know, access to that audience, your value to a brand increases exponentially. And so being able to sort of figure out how, you know, going back to the fan engagement experience, can brands be woven into that in some way that's resonant, and they help create trends? Like, these are all sort of dream scenarios, but look at the development of Nike as a company. It's all been done on the back of that.
Yeah.
Really, like the core component of the growth, Gatorade, like, these are brands that are built out of the culture of the sport, and the youth being able to form it as either fashion or routine. And so, like, these are all things that we're thinking about in terms of, like, the growth. You know, you've sort of pointed out sort of targeting the audience segments. For me, I'm thinking about, you know, that sort of core 12 to 34 audience.
Yeah.
Is being the ones that are going to shape perception of the sport. Is it cool or is it not cool? Really, I mean, it's sort of at the end of the day, it's kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we have a great opportunity to do that because it is such a compelling experience to go to the games. And I think we can create a super compelling experience of watching the games or consuming the content in any platform, in any form. But that's the goal we're shooting for. Like, it's cool to be associated with it. It's cool to wear the gear. You know, that's a challenge, but that's also the opportunity.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's a cool sport. I was lucky enough to be a game announcer early in my career at Worcester Wolves up the road from the west of England. Unfortunately, they've withdrawn from the BBL now, but that was a great experience and it's some great nights there. And I think, yeah, I'd encourage anyone to go along to a game. Where is the best place for someone to find out about their team, their local team, where they might get into it? Is it the BBL website? Is that a good launch pad?
Yeah, and we're going to be relaunching the BBL website later this summer. But it's a good starting point. You know, we're going to be doing a ton of things sort of on the back end side of the business to create a much more robust digital infrastructure where we are able to create a more direct connection and relationship with our fans. And there's all sorts of tools, you know, that the internet enables to facilitate that. And that sort of goes, you know, back to your original point, which is the barriers to entry of, you know, creating an audience for yourself are very low. Mm. The tools are there. It's how you, you know, it's how you leverage and it's how you leverage those tools to create that engagement.
Absolutely. A world of choice. We've all got so much choice as well. And I appreciate you spending your time and choosing to spend it on the podcast Sport and Life.
Of course, Teddy. Thank you.
Thank you for being on.
Of course. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Love that conversation. Good on Aaron Radin as well for all the community work he did in his Brooklyn, New York days. And I think that basketball has the potential, doesn't it, to target those communities as well, because all you do need is a hoop. Yeah, you need a hoop. So it's slightly more complicated than football or soccer with the old jumpers, sweaters for goals, they'd call them in the States. But I think it's still very accessible for many people around the world. It is a global sport. It'd be interesting to see if it catches on more in the UK. I often wondered why it hasn't in our miserable winters, and also the health and side of it, you know, with all the contact sports now being associated with head trauma, CTE, very big issues in rugby, football, soccer, obviously American football as well. So I think basketball potentially has an angle there. And also, but then I wonder, things like handball, very big in Europe, haven't taken off in the UK necessarily. It's part of that kind of all-consuming football, soccer kind of culture, isn't it, to a certain extent. And as much as I love football as much as the next person, it's great to have a diversity of sport as well. Big thank you to Aaron. Check out the British Basketball League online. Get in touch and find out where you can go and watch a game, you know, and take your kids if you've got them. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to rate it on iTunes, Spotify, write a review, that'd be hugely appreciated. Or just tell a friend. Thank you to the sponsors as well. Remember the association with Herring Shoes. If you go to herringshoes.co.uk, TED10, T-E-D, all capital letters, numerals 10, for 10% off. For Cytoplan, 30% off your first purchase of supplements at cytoplan.co.uk, cytoplan.co.uk is the website, and you get 10% ongoing with the code DRAPER10R, my last name, DRAPER, all capital letters, numerals 10, and the capital letter R. Thank you to Bang & Olufsen of Cheltenham and Serena V, specialists in the finest home entertainment brands, providing solutions based around high quality customer service and installations, for their continued support. Appreciate it. Appreciate you listening. I hope you have a fantastic week and speak to you again soon. Goodbye for now.